Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, May 14th. I'm Lauren Schmidt, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Fallow Cannabis Farm comes back to life. Humboldt Harbor District seeks funding for Shelter Cove repairs. And the California Public Utilities Commission approves electricity rate changes. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. Humboldt County is concerned about the condition of abandoned former cannabis farm sites, but the Planning Commission approved permits for one that's being restored. KMUD's Daniel Mintz reports.
A defunct cannabis farming site in the southern Humboldt area is being revived with numerous site improvements under permits approved by the county's Planning Commission. The approvals made at the May 2nd Commission meeting clear the way for about 18,000 square feet of outdoor greenhouse farming and environmental improvements like moving former greenhouses out of a streamside management area, or SMA. The 80-acre farm property is off Salmon Creek Road in the Miranda area and will include an 1,800-square-foot nursery and water storage tanks. An existing barn will be used for drying and curing. A water right allows diversion from an unnamed tributary, but rain catchment will reduce reliance on it. All power will be provided by solar arrays and no generators will be used. There's been no cannabis farming on the site since 2014, and the applicant, Virgil Wilner of Mattol Valley Farms Business Support Services, LLC, talked about the condition of the property and how he's changed it.
I believe the previous owners were laxive. I think they were using the extensive time in the LSA to kind of just extend their, abuse of kind of the privilege of that timeline. They hadn't done anything with the SMAs. All the soil and everything was still in it from when they had left it 10 years ago. They had all sorts of fans and generators, which were probably annoying the neighbors in the area, and all of that has been removed. It's all going to be solar. There's going to be no generators. All of the SMAs have been addressed and remitigated and strawed and waddled. I brought all that stuff back into compliance.
The county is increasingly concerned about an increase in the number of abandoned and impacted properties in the wake of the cannabis industry downturn. Wilner said his plans to transform his parcel into a working farm takes a problem off the county's hands.
We took a neglected piece that's basically a problem for the county. He had back taxes that he hadn't paid on this property for up to 4 years. So by me taking over this project and bringing it into compliance, I basically helped out the county by paying the fees and bringing all of the attention that basically you want put to a project has been done. And I've pretty much cleaned up a big mess for everybody, and now it's compliant.
During public comment, there were questions about the road serving the project, and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, or CDFW, describing the project's site plan as inconsistent and confusing. Wilner acknowledged that, quote, it was a crappy plot plan, but it was immediately redone, he said, to CDFW's satisfaction. The road in question has turnarounds for emergency vehicles and has also gotten sign-off from the CDFW, he continued. With site improvements afoot and no troublesome issues to resolve, the commission unanimously approved the permits. Also at the meeting, Planning Director John Ford briefed commissioners on the status of cannabis farming and its impacts on the county's watersheds, as was discussed during a recent Board of Supervisors meeting. A resolution on cannabis permitting caps in watersheds also required water quality and flow monitoring, and Ford explained why it hasn't been done.
When that resolution was prepared, it was anticipated that the Regional Water Quality Control Board, Department of Fish and Wildlife, would be collecting stream flow information, water quality information, and that that would begin to establish a data set that could be monitored to demonstrate the effectiveness of the regulatory environment that's been established in Humboldt County and also elsewhere in the state. That never did really materialize. So we did not submit a report, and it was pointed out during the discussions on Measure A that an annual report was required, and we looked at the resolution, and that is absolutely required. And so we started this year by providing a report of what's happened to date.
Commissioner Noah Levy suggested asking non-governmental agencies for data. He said groups like Sanctuary Forest, the Salmonid Restoration Federation, Trout Unlimited, and CalTrout have been monitoring various stream flows, quote, for a good number of years. As reported to supervisors, the cultivation cap's total is 3,500 permits, and to date, only about 1,000 have been approved. The cap's total about 1,200 acres, and total approved acreage is only 388 acres. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
PG&E will be conducting helicopter patrols in southern Humboldt starting tomorrow, May 15th, and will be flying through Sunday, May 19th, for compliance inspections. The helicopters will be flying during daylight hours and will be surveying PG&E equipment in the following areas: Garberville, Alder Point, Bloxburg, Bell Springs, Ruth Lake, Dinsmore, Bridgeville, Myers Flat, and Fruitland. Residents with questions, comments, or concerns can direct them online at pge.com. The Humboldt Bay Harbor District is seeking funding for Shelter Cove repairs. Kelly Lincoln brings us a report on their progress towards funding the Shelter Cove breakwater.
At the May 9th Harbor District meeting, the commissioners received a budget presentation. In a phone interview afterward, Chris Mickelson, general manager for the Humboldt Bay Harbor Recreation and Conservation District, described the sequential steps the district takes from March through the adoption of a final budget in July. Mickelson summarized the presentation to the commission and the public at their board meeting on May 9th, focusing on key projects such as the Shelter Cove boat launch and Redwood Marine Terminal 2. Mickelson began with plans for rebuilding the breakwater at Shelter Cove. The municipality of Shelter Cove, formerly known as Resort Improvement District No. 1, is generally called the RID. The Harbor District holds responsibility for the boat launch and holds the state tidelands in trust. The district maintains responsibility for the infrastructure. This includes upkeep of the fish cleaning station and the road leading to the launch and the launch itself. Meanwhile, the boat launch operations are outsourced or subleased to the Shelter Cove Fishermen's Preservation Group. The Harbor District is also responsible for maintaining the breakwater that shelters the cove. Mickelson elaborates on the troubles there and describes their budget plans for repair.
In 2022, we had significant storm surge, and it undermined the breakwater there, which is the area that protects the boat launch apron and allows people to safely launch. Because of the extreme surf, it was covered in great amounts of marine debris, which was on the top surface logs and other woods that float in the ocean. Below that was an immense amount of gravel and sand coming out of the ocean, which covered the entire boat launch. The breakwater was underpinned, and by that I mean the wave action broke out the smaller pieces of the base of that breakwater and ultimately allowed some of the larger rock to move. And so we applied to FEMA for a grant to not only clean the boat launch apron, but to also rebuild the breakwater and what they call a mitigation, which allows us to apply for additional funds to better armor the breakwater, which means place more or larger rock and a greater footprint over it in order to ensure this doesn't happen again. And so while we've been in negotiations, or application would be a better way to state it, with FEMA for the better part of now nearly 18 months, I think it began in January of 2023, FEMA has now come forward. Well, they haven't granted us funding yet. They're negotiating on the amounts in which they will fund. And it looks like we're now going to receive the monies to go ahead and proceed with the permitting and planning necessary to do the work down at the boat launch. So it's a big win. It's huge.
Mickelson went on to say he is striving to work closely on the project with the RID's new manager.
Shelter Cove is one of the absolute gems of our region. And as you know, pretty much everything in our region is a gem. But Shelter Cove, it's just unbelievable scenery. It's a wonderful place to visit. It's very remote, as each one of us knows. It's an incredible drive to get there. But, you know, we want to do right in that community. We want to make sure that we're representing it well. And I spoke with the general manager of the RID today, Chris Christensen. It was our first introduction to one another. He's fairly new on the job. And, you know, talked about this is coming your way and want to make sure, you know, we know one another and we can work together collectively. And he welcomed us down there with open arms. So that was nice, too.
Moving up to Humboldt Bay, Mickelson described another big repair project the district must budget for due to this past winter's rough seas.
So I think the big investment this year at Redwood Marine Terminal Number 2 is the former pulp mill, as everyone knows, has a marine outfall line which was extended due to a settlement with Surfrider to go out 1 mile and 1.5 into the Pacific Ocean. Us beachgoers know that we lose a large portion of our beach each year through erosion. The good news is about the time it starts to go away, the winds come in, and it naturally builds back the sand. This was an anomaly this year. We had a pounding surf, we had an extremely wet winter, and we lost a huge portion of our beach. At one point, our outfall line started to become exposed. Before long, we were seeing a big portion of our outfall line. All of a sudden, the beach was missing underneath the outfall line, and then a section of it floated. At least we believe it floated. We weren't there to witness it. But we got a convex portion. So we applied for an emergency coastal development permit, working with the California Coastal Commission and other agencies, and of course, immediately went to work to secure the outfall line. And right now, there's a temporary repair in place, which is armor the outfall line with bags of rock, and that holds the line in place. Over the course of the next coming months, we will go through the permitting and planning process and the evaluation process through engineering to determine what a permanent repair looks like and then execute on that. And so that's the big project this year at Redwood Marine Terminal 2.
Mickelson said the outfall line is important to the Nordic Aqua Farms project and that the Coastal Commission gave approval on their permit this month.
Some of the things we're budgeting for to secure the site, and that's because we were delighted to receive approval last week from the California Coastal Commission on one of our permits. So we are getting very close to Nordic Aqua Farms becoming a reality here on the North Coast. And of course, they'll utilize that outfall line.
This is Kelly Lincoln reporting for KMUD News.
In other Shelter Cove news, there is a scheduled power outage on Wednesday, May 15th from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. The Resort Improvement District electrical crew will be replacing power poles impacting Ridge, Madrone, Spring, and Eileen roads. Turning to Mendocino, the Kelly House Museum is currently showing an exhibit, The First Black Man in Mendocino, highlighting the life of Nathaniel Smith. KZYX's Marty Derlin shares this report.
Born in Maryland in 1831 of free parents, he left Baltimore in 1847 on a ship bound for China and ended up in Mendocino County 4 years later. Kelly House Museum Director Ann Siemens takes up the tale.
So this teenager gets on a ship and, you know, heads around the Cape Horn and is on his way up. They're making all the stops. We have the map here. And by the time they get to the Hawaiian Islands, gold is discovered and word has gotten out. And so whatever journey they had originally planned, they headed straight for San Francisco from Hawaii. And that's how he ended up in San Francisco.
In the first of a series of entrepreneurial ventures, Nathaniel Smith set up a ferry company from San Francisco to Sausalito, rigging a sail to a small boat and charging $16 a trip. In 1851, he left Sausalito on a whaling ship and landed on the Mendocino coast. He died here in 1906 at the age of 75.
It's interesting to think about this man, you know, who kind of lived through these turbulent times, not just in terms of, you know, rugged Mendocino, there's nothing here when he arrives and he's part of this community that's being built, but he's also a second-class citizen, right? He couldn't marry a white person. He couldn't testify against a white person in court. He was married twice to Pomo women. So, you know, he navigated those waters while also being incredibly resourceful. I mean, he was a logger. He hunted for the logging company. He fished. He traded. He was a stagecoach driver. He was a teamster, right? So he had many different hats that he was able to wear in order to
survive.
Ann Seaman says the Nathaniel Smith exhibit, the first of its kind, began with her question to a Mendocino High School history teacher about what students wanted to know about the history of the area.
So at the time, Black Lives Matter was in full swing, and she said, you know, they want to know stories about Black people in Mendocino, and were there any? And I knew about Nathaniel Smith. He was one of the first people to settle here, and, you know, nothing had been done about him. So in that sense, the high school students' curiosity is why we're having the exhibit now. We just had this year's high school field trips. You know, they come down from Mendocino High. We get 4 classes and 80 kids come down over 2 days. And so I got to watch them interact with the exhibit and, you know, ask us questions and just have that we had no idea moment. We had in our own research at the Kelly House, you know, different citations for where we'd seen his name come up, for example, in newspapers. He was written about in the Mendocino Beacon a lot. He actually appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle, the LA Times. He was written about quite frequently for someone who was alive in the, you know, the 1860s. But we ended up getting a small grant from the California Humanities, which allowed us to hire a researcher. And he was his name was Alexander Wood, and he had graduated recently with a master's in history. And he was able to really go deeper and scour the historical record, not just for information about Nathaniel Smith, but we wanted to overlay Nathaniel Smith's story on top of what was happening in California at the same time that would have affected his quality of life. So that's what you see in the exhibit today. You have this marvelous timeline here on the table that shows, you know, Nathaniel Smith's journey, but it also talks about, hey, the Fugitive Slave Act existed when he got here. And that meant that, you know, Black people, even free Black people, were afraid that they could be captured and sent to a slave state. One of the connections that came out of it, which is really exciting, was with state parks, because they are doing some work through all the state park system with the California African American Museum, and they are trying to bring to the forefront histories like Nathaniel Smith. So African Americans, Black people who lived in California in this time period, what was it like for them? Because you don't really see that reflected in a lot of the museum or the park, state parks interpretations. And they would like to use the research that we did with Nathaniel Smith and figure out how to bring it into the state park system. So in that respect, we're just thrilled that it's going beyond, you know, this time period right here that we have at the Kelly House to show the material, and that his story will get out there more.
He had one of the hugest funerals, at least up to that date, in the area. Mm. What was so interesting, attractive, accessible about him?
Well, it sounds like, aside from being incredibly resourceful, right? So when you needed somebody to do something, right? Ferry you across the river, go hunt for your lumber company. So he plugged into a lot of sub-communities in Mendocino at the time. But also, he just sounded like an affable person, right? He's kind of, you know, the words wit and repartee come up in different references to him. So I think he was an engaging personality, and that made him well liked. And yeah, I don't know how else to answer that question other than he, you know, he had his fingers in a lot of pies, mm-hmm. and he was a charming guy.
The Nathaniel Smith exhibit runs through May 27th at the Kelly House in Mendocino Village. For KZYX, I'm Marty Derlin.
In state news, the CPUC approves electricity rate changes. KPFA's Eileen Alfandari shares this report.
The California Public Utilities Commission unanimously voted to change the way PG&E and other private utilities charge households for electricity. Starting in early 2026, PG&E customers will face a new fixed charge of $24.15 on their electric bills every month. The charge takes effect at the end of next year for customers of Southern California Edison and San Diego Gas and Electric. At the same time, the price of electricity per kilowatt hour will drop. PUC Commission Chair Alice Reynolds said the change is aimed at encouraging people to switch to electric appliances and electric vehicles by making each unit of electricity cheaper.
And the reason customers are financially better off is because the new billing structure will reduce the price per unit of electricity by roughly 5 to 7 cents per kilowatt hour. This means that every time a customer plugs in their electric vehicle to a level 2 charger or dials up their electric heat pump, the price of that electricity they use will be cheaper.
PUC commissioners also said it's only fair that everyone pay the fixed charge for electric transmission poles, lines, and other equipment, no matter how much electricity they use. Some consumer and environmental groups backed the change, like the Utility Reform Network, known as TURN, and the Natural Resources Defense Council. Others opposed it. Yvette DiCarlo spoke before the commissioners voted.
I'm here on behalf of 260 nonprofit organizations opposed to the big utility tax that will increase monthly utility bills on 4 million households while doing nothing to encourage electrification or get at the root problem of rising energy costs. It simply shifts ever-rising costs around. The losers are people living in apartments and small homes who are categorically low income, while benefiting those who live in larger homes.
The Environmental Working Group argued the fixed charge would end up penalizing the approximately 20% of Californians who use less electricity than the average ratepayer. That's because the $24 fixed charge will outweigh any savings those ratepayers realize in lower per-unit costs of electricity. Solar advocates said the fixed charge will be another financial disincentive to investing in rooftop solar panels. Very low-income customers on the CARE or FARA plans will pay $6 and $12 monthly charges, respectively. California Senate Republicans urged the PUC not to go ahead with its vote on a new fixed charge, and some California Assembly Democrats pushed legislation to limit the monthly charge to $10. But the Democratic Assembly leader blocked a committee vote on the bill. Californians already pay among the highest electric rates in the country and have been hit with a recent series of rate hikes. More than a million PG&E customers are behind in paying their bills. I'm Eileen Alfandari for KPFA News.
KMET News will bring you more details on the rate changes later this week. Activists push for housing bond for California fall election. Christopher Martinez reports.
The philosopher Karl Marx once said that philosophers interpret the world, but the important thing is to change it. That sentiment often moves activists like Gabby Trejo, the director of Sacramento ACT, Sacramento Area Congregations Together.
Today we are here not to say we think you should think about housing, but to say you have an opportunity to make our state affordable again.
Trejo was the MC at a news conference that brought together housing activists and lawmakers, all to support a $10 billion affordable housing bond they want to put on the November ballot. But first, they have to get the legislature to pass the bill to put it on the ballot. And that means Assembly Bill 1647, the Affordable Housing Bond Act, by Democratic Assemblymember Buffy Wicks of Oakland. She says a new poll shows 60% of Californians think there should be a housing bond on the ballot.
We are going to fight like hell to make sure we get this bond on the ballot. And we are talking to the speaker and the pro tem and the governor and all the legislators. So you got to call all your legislators, people like us. You got to hold our feet to the fire. You got to tell them you support the housing bond AB 1657 on the ballot now.
The event included other lawmakers, Senator Nancy Skinner of Berkeley and Maria Durazo of Los Angeles, as well as activists like Marjorie Beezer of Sacramento ACT.
You see me? I live in a vehicle, an abandoned vehicle on the south side of Sacramento, and have been for the last 2 years. Do I look like my condition?
No.
No, ma'am.
And why don't I? Because I'm showing up for you.
Michelle Parisette is with the nonprofit group Public Advocates. She talked about the human and moral costs of inaction.
The homelessness crisis is a profound failure of our society to protect our most marginalized. It's unacceptable that in the richest state, in the richest country in the history of the world, 181,000 members of our communities are forced to struggle in homelessness for lack of affordable housing.
Justine Marcus is with the group Enterprise Community Partners. She says the affordable housing bond could jumpstart construction on 47,000 affordable homes that have already been approved but lack funding to move forward. She says the bond could transform lives.
These homes would serve over 500,000 California families over the next 5 decades. That is an opportunity, a lifeline for Californians that we cannot afford to miss or delay. Every month, every year that these developments sit in the pipeline, costs increase, inflation takes a toll, and far too many Californians are forced to stay on the street.
After the news conference, the activists went into the Capitol to lobby lawmakers to support AB 1657. The measure needs a supermajority to put the bond on the November ballot. Francisco Duenas of the group Housing Now says activists will keep fighting because California cannot afford more homelessness and more evictions.
And so the thing that I just wanted to share with you all or remind us about is the urgency. The urgency of this need now. Californians need us to act now, right? It's housing now that we need. And our legislators need to hear that. And please share that message when you go back home, because as we said, we're going to put this on the ballot and we need to convince all our friends and neighbors to come out and vote for this.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Kelly Lincoln, Marty Derlin, Eileen Alfandary, and Christopher Martinez. KMA News is online. You can find us on KMA.org, SoundCloud, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see stories, links, and videos. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send us an email to news@KMA.org. Reporting from our studio in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.